Today we're looking at myself in relationship. I'd like to start by just recapping a little bit the six dimensions of wellness, and some of you that were here last week, this will be sort of a review. I look at wellness as many others do. This is actually a model from the National Wellness Institute in Wisconsin, Stevens Point, Wisconsin, that talks about wellness as a holistic model. There are many different models, most of them holistic and have different names to them, but this one I like in terms of looking at the different dimensions of the self. We have the occupational, physical, spiritual, emotional, the social, which involves family, community, and environment, and then the intellectual. I, as a self, encompass all of these aspects. I don't live in one or two only. Those are all functions of who I am. Now, wellness in these different dimensions is a process of becoming aware, discovering new things about who I am and who others are and what my world is like and how I relate to that, changing and growing. The process of becoming a self is a lifelong process. It's not something that we begin and suddenly discover, okay, I now am a self and I don't have to work at it anymore. It is a continual discovery, beginning at birth and even before, in utero, and goes on until death. A book that I mentioned last week, and I think they've sold out of at the bookstore, is a book called The Measure of My Days by Florida Scott Maxwell. And she wrote that at age 80, looking back at the growth and change and process of becoming a self. And she says, and I quote, "It has taken me all the time I've had to become myself. Yet now that I am old, there are times when I feel that I am barely here, no room for me at all." The process of becoming a self. Now, as an individual, we grow and change in each of these areas, each in our own way and each in our own time. And yet, in our society, it seems like we're always trying to compare ourselves with somebody else. It's sort of like comparing apples and oranges. If I compare the way I'm growing to the way you're growing, it doesn't make a lot of sense, although we do have certain milestones or guidelines that we use for evaluation purposes. But sometimes we get kind of stuck in that. And if we haven't reached a certain level at a certain age, then we begin to wonder what's wrong with this person. But we progress at different levels, at a different pace. We also progress within ourselves at a different pace and different timing. We have different spurts of physical growth. We all know that. Certain ages, six to eight, is that when we have this great spurt of growth as a child, and again at puberty, there's a spurt of growth. And we sort of take that for granted. We have growths within our intellectual life. Children start out learning right after birth. They're constantly in a process of learning. But then we put them into schools and give them education to develop their intellect. Occupational. We grow and work towards some ideas of what we want to be as a person, what we want to do. And there's some growing and changing in that area. Also here, in terms of social, we began to relate. As very young children, we began to relate to each other. We began to relate to people in our family and the larger community. And there's a process of growing and changing there. It seems to me that the two areas where growth and change are more problematic are in the emotional and in the spiritual. And you may disagree with me on this. But I find, working as a counselor with college students, that emotional growth is out of sync often with their intellectual growth. And my husband, who teaches Bible and religion in college, often recognizes in the spiritual growth that students come at a point where they're still back at an early Sunday school knowledge and experience and attitude about their spiritual life. So why is it that somehow we seem to grow in some of these areas at a faster rate than we do in others? Maybe we tend to idolize some or idealize some areas more than others. Certainly in the academic world where my husband and I work, the intellect becomes idealized. Somehow to allow the intellect to grow and change seems to have more significance and be more important than the emotional. And we have this funny idea in our society that, particularly around brains or beauty, if somebody has brains and we recognize that that person is intelligent, then we attribute that they're at the same level of growth and maturity in all other aspects of their life. Wrong. It's a myth. I have this dear friend who's a wonderful intellectual. He's an abstract thinker, he writes books, he writes in journals, is well thought of. But his emotional life right now is in chaos. He's had some crises in his life, but he's discovered that he has not been attending to the emotional area in the same way that he's been attending to his intellect. So he's had to go back and rework at an earlier developmental level, almost back at an adolescent level, to begin to get in touch with his emotions and to bring them up to a level that is at least in some balance. Strange, isn't it, how we sort of compartmentalize ourselves and think of ourselves in one area and not in another. I think for some people, and maybe for many of you men in the group, the occupational or vocational often becomes the area that receives more investment of time and energy. And maybe the social, the family, the emotional are not kept in sync with the others. We need to attend to each one of these areas of ourselves, not the same intensity at the same time, but to check them out periodically and find out if one of those areas is out of sync. What do I do about it? How do I begin to do something more about relationships within family, friends, community kinds of involvements, concerns about the environment, the global environment, Have I been deficient in that area? What about the emotional area? What about my feelings and attitudes? Do I need to put more time or energies into that area? I think each one of us as children, and even in utero, we began to be in relationship in utero, and as infants in the bonding process, maybe positive bonding, maybe not. And during childhood, we are constantly in connection with people around us, and that at an early stage is our family. The family shapes our ideas, our attitudes, and we develop a working hypothesis about what our world is like, what my reality is like within that family context and within that larger community context. Now that's going to be different for me than it's going to be for you. What your working hypothesis is going to be what fits for you, what fits for surviving and maturing in that family system. Our families are significant shapers of this hypothesis. We learn as children to look to others and to learn how to invoke their love, invoke their sympathy and understanding in order to get our needs met. And we develop our own kind of bag of fears, of apprehensions, of feelings. We make observations that are all part of this hypothesis that we have, this reality that helps us to survive, to feel secure, and to feel good in the environment in which we're living. Now, these childhood hypotheses work for us until we began to mature and gain new experiences. And if we keep plugging in our new experiences to those childhood, to that childhood framework, something's going to go awry. Because they work for us as a child, but that does not mean that they necessarily are going to work for us as adults. It means that we are not looking at them and revising them and changing them to fit who we are as growing, maturing adults. We grow by becoming more of who we are. And there's a great potential that each one of us has. Mine is different from yours. So we need to build on those childhood, that childhood hypothesis, the strengths of that, and let go of some of the other aspects of that that aren't working for us anymore. And each of you can probably think about your own situation and what you have had to let go of and what have been good strengths that and resources that you have continued to have as a part of your hypothesis as you continue to grow. I think of some of the children that come from alcoholic families or dysfunctional families, we now call them, who have learned three things. Basically, not to trust, not to talk, and not to feel. And I've worked with many of them in the college setting. That hypothesis that worked for them in their family because it meant that they could survive in that family system. is really a detriment to that person as he or she begins to move out into the adult world. Remember a woman I worked with that was very bright, a wonderful person, but she was so afraid of even raising her hand in the classroom to ask a question for fear of what the teacher might think of her. And that fear was related to the hypothesis that she had set up in her home system where you did not ask questions, because that authority figure could destroy you, could do things that made life very difficult. And that fear continued for her. And to work through that was a slow process, but it was important for her to do that in order to begin to live a healthier, more nurturing life and be able to relate to other people that she came in contact with. So we need to learn what to let go of the old beliefs and attitudes that prevent us from growing as whole people. We need to learn to love and to nurture ourselves. It's easy to talk about, but how do you learn to love and nurture yourself? Who I am, what I think about myself, can be a very positive resource, and it can help me cope with any situation that I come up with. If I have a negative sense of myself, then it can be a stressor in and of itself. Because if I perceive myself in a negative way, if I don't think I'm worth very much, then I'm going to carry that attitude into any situation I'm in. And I'm going to interpret situations that reinforce that negative attitude about myself. One of the books, maybe some of you read this, I think it's a great book. It's by John Powell, who is a Jesuit priest, called Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? I think they have this in the bookstore too. It's an easy to read little book with pictures as well as script. And it's insights on self-awareness and personal growth and communicating with each other. Why am I afraid to tell you who I am?
Who's it by?
John Powell. Powell. Mm-hmm. He also has one on loving. Why am I afraid to love? And he answers this question by saying, I'm afraid to tell you who I am because if I tell you who I really am, you may not like me. And you may leave and go away. And then I will be all alone. So at one level, if I'm not feeling very good about myself, I'm not going to feel very free to share who I am as a person. So I'll keep up this facade. And we all do this to some extent. We all keep a kind of facade out here. The ideal self. But the more I can be in touch with this self that has both strengths and weaknesses, that is able to succeed as well as to fail, the more I can accept both parts, all aspects of myself, the better I'm going to feel about who I am. And relating to the self is pretty basic for relating to anybody else. If I don't feel very good about me, then I'm not going to feel so good about you either. Or I'm going to need you to prop up that part of me that isn't feeling good. And that's not really very healthy in a relationship. So one of the questions I would like to, I really see this as a conversation where we're just beginning to talk about the self in relationship. Not coming up with a lot of answers, but beginning conversation about this, that hopefully you can begin to, you will continue to think about and work on with yourselves and yourself in relationship to others. I would like to ask the question, to look at some, first to look at some images of the self, and maybe I'll just do some reading about images of the self, and then ask you, what image or images you have of yourself, and how do they help you connect or not connect with others? I'm going to do some reading about this. Let's see. Images of the self. Karen Horney, who is a psychoanalyst, says this: the individual who has lost contact with herself or himself has to prove that she or he is something that she or he is not. If I've lost contact with myself, then I have to prove that I am something that I am not. Soren Kierkegaard, the philosopher, says, generally speaking, consciousness, that is self-consciousness, is decisive with regard to the self. The more conscious, the more self. The more conscious, the more will. The more will, the more self. A person who has no will at all is not a self. But the more will he has, the more self-conscious he has also. How about that for a philosophical? Joseph Sittler, who's recently died and was a theologian that worked at Chicago, at the University of Chicago Divinity School, had a small article on finding and knowing yourself. I think I'll read this whole thing because he writes in such a way that is easy to identify with. I think the assumption that first you must know yourself and then you decide what to do with yourself is a fundamental blunder. The truth of the matter is that one does not know himself or herself. That's a false conclusion, because the self is not an isolated entity. The self is constituted by its relationships, and the only self-knowledge we can have is the knowledge that comes by virtue of the self being among other selves. People frequently ask me how to find and know the self. Let me be quite personal. In my reflection, I have come to the surprising conclusion that I never asked that question. It seems to be a traumatic one for many, but it has never been of concern to me. In a sense, I have been greatly blessed by having had a modest self-image as a child. I had a very smart older brother and a very beautiful older sister. I was just the third kid, and therefore I would simply open my eyes, look around and gawk and enjoy whatever there was to enjoy. By never asking who I was, I developed a self without pressing the question. Young people often come to me and say, I may drop out of school or leave this place or quit my job. I've got to go off by myself and find out who I am. Well, I can understand the pathos of the situation and what motivates their feeling and can be patient with their convictions. At the same time, I'm very dubious as to the success. There's a poem by Theodore Rothke that says, I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. Joe Sittler continues, you find that yourself emerges more quickly if you do not keep scratching the question. If you lose your life, you find it, or it could be that it will find you. You will say, now that seems to be what I am or what I'd like to do. I don't think you go to some sterile, barren land filled with sagebrush and gaze at your navel to find out who you are. That's Joe Sittler. James Nelson, who also teaches theology in Minnesota and has written some books on sexuality, says, self-love and other love are all of one piece. They are indivisible. Neither is a means to the end of the other. I can love the other only when I love myself, and myself only when I love the other. Both loves are a moral obligation for Christians. Indeed, they are not loves so much as facets of love. And in the New Testament, we read that we are to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. That's a verse that I think has often been taken, interpreted differently. Sometimes the neighbor becomes more important than yourself. But what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? Robert Bly, the poet from Minnesota, has a line in one of his poems that says, when people grow old, they become more like themselves again. Also a biblical verse that talks about we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. What does it mean to be made ourselves, made in the image of God? And finally, Tillich, another theologian, who wrote several books and was a very profound thinker, talks about life processes including two basic elements, self-identity and self-alteration. A centered and balanced living whole goes beyond itself, separates itself partly from its unity, but in so doing, it tries to preserve its identity and to return in its separated parts to itself, going out from oneself and returning to oneself characterizes life under all dimensions. Just a few images of the self. You may find yourself in some, you may not. You have your own images. So I guess I'd like to open it up and talk about what images of the self are you living by? Do these images reflect who you are as a whole person or only a part of that person? And are there pieces of that that need to be changed? What images are you living by? Who are you? Who do you think of? What do you think of yourself?
For myself, I've been in a very stretching growth process the last 5 years. And I realize as I look at your diagram up here that all of my areas were really out of balance. Everything was, I was still back using the childhood hypotheses at a very late age of my life. And now, since this process, every one of those areas has been called into question. Maybe the physical, not so much as the rest, but the occupational. I was a professional volunteer. I did what everybody else wanted me to do. Never took into consideration really what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. The intellectual, I've gone back to school. Really stretched myself in that area. The social, a lot of my identity was tied up in being a wife and mother, and that's just gone completely topsy-turvy. The emotional, I didn't know how to feel. And I've learned how to feel, and sometimes I just assume I hadn't.
Rather painful when you get in touch with those feelings,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I know what the dysfunctional family is, as probably most people do, or many people anyway. In the spiritual, I hadn't really, all I did was to take in what other people said was right. Right.
Right.
For them. And that's been a very painful part of the process, too, to start making my own decisions. So who am I now? I don't know. I'm just learning.
But you're in process of growing and changing in a way that you were not before. You're more aware of what that is. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I can really identify with that. I'm not sure that I would venture to guess that most people, most women who find themselves in the role of wife and mother and professional volunteer, like I have been, I think that we find ourselves in that same boat. And hopefully we have things that jar us, as obviously something has done for you, that continue to help us grow. I also don't feel like I've been in a vacuum, or I think I've grown in the process of volunteering and knowing other people and seeing how this is going, but maybe growing in knowing that I'm not alone, I guess. I'm probably at the beginning stages of what you've already pushed through.
I'm not through yet.
Probably none of us will be.
Yes.
Do you think it's possible to be totally in sync at all times, or we just constantly?
No.
I feel it looks more like a game of Trivial Pursuit, where you take out one pie and back in and go on with life. I mean, you don't really achieve that at any point in life.
I don't think one ever does.
Along.
No, no. And that's where probably need a different different way of putting this model together that would reflect different stages.
Because obviously we need something to challenge us spiritually. Get us back together a little bit, and then that works on the emotional and.
I think we're often a little out of, usually out of sync.
Uh-huh.
But the issue is how far out, and if we're so focusing there, so much.
Should self be in the center then? I mean, should that be?
I think that's a good thing. Why don't we put self in the center there? Good. Yes.
Something that has come to my awareness just in the last couple months, after having a large growth period because of a personal crisis, and the awareness that if crisis for people from dysfunctional families is how they feel alive and how they feel growth or feel what the parts of themselves. I'm not sure exactly how to put this all into words because it's just starting to make sense. But now, after having dealt with that crisis 3-4 years ago, and now in the everyday sort of ordinary everyday life, learning to have the growth through everyday ordinary experiences and relationships, rather than through continual crisis.
And that's a very different feeling, a very different way of relating, isn't it?
Feels much better. It feels much better.
Moving through the ordinary, daily.
Yeah, and learning to grow in that.
Rather than leaping from crisis to crisis.
Right. Well, I was just reading, I don't remember the name of the book, it's the sequel to the adult children of alcoholics, and it's the one on interpersonal relationships. And I was just reading through the chapter on, and I said, oh my, do I do this? Growing up in a roller coaster family, things are going well, real well, and then you start picking on somebody, or you start the roller coaster because that's what feels normal. I mean, life is this way, you know. I mean, you deal well when you're hot and going. And I have a very even keeled husband, and the comment it said was, you kind of resent them because at times, you know. It's just too even keeled, and you kick them, you know. So anyway, I kind of relate to what you're saying because it's, and I had just this morning, you know, that had just hit me. I thought, oh my, this is what I do, you know, this is me. So it goes on all the time.
Speaking of recent revelations, I had a very absent childhood, you know, one of those with Spot and the dog, and everything was happy and it was wonderful. And I was always very cheerful. And as I grew older, I somehow got the idea that being cheerful and nice was a weakness. So for many years I worked on being as nasty as possible. And I succeeded very well. But somehow just recently in a class I took just in the past month, I realized cheerfulness and enthusiasm was a gift. Okay, and I had never thought of it as a gift before. I thought it was being a doormat. But being nice and greasing the skids is a talent too, and I never saw it as that before. So I have to go back and try to be nice again.
So in a way, you rejected much of that childhood hypothesis and switched over to something that you thought was going to be more workable. Mm-hmm. But now you've gone back to build on the strengths of that.
Yeah, it's real new though. So some people told me that I was nice and they really liked that. I thought, oh, okay, I'll try that.
And that's, I think, part of the process of checking it out and letting go of some things and building on others and keeping, knowing what's worthwhile keeping for you.
So I have to get a balance between doormat and rotten, I guess.
You have to be honest to yourself. It has to be a certain amount of honesty there.
And not necessarily taking somebody else's word for it.
No.
It's what feels okay for you.
It has to be authoritative.
And what works for you. And you know, we each of us know when we're not being true to ourselves.
Otherwise we get to be wishy-washy.
How do we know?
That also is a process of that one develops, I think. Some know it, some don't. That intuitive sense of, or a gut feeling of, something's not quite right here, something's out of balance. Maybe you disagree.
So how do you learn that? I mean, what do you do? I mean, some people go to the mountaintop to find that out, to isolate themselves, to find out what that inner voice is, what that sense is.
Because it gets drowned out by so much of just the busyness of life.
Yeah, the clutter of life. I mean, what do you focus on in your life?
Pardon?
What do you focus on in your life? Something that you have to determine. How you spend your time, your energy, your resources. And making those choices is really tough.
It's very tough. It's not an easy process at all. Anybody have any suggestions as what has worked for them?
What's worked for me is just to start to talk to a real good friend and have their feedback, and then the answer will come to you yourself. But the more you talk about it, you'll arrive at the answer. It's happened to me many times. I'll have no idea the reason I feel the way I do, but I'll receive the answer within myself in a conversation with a good friend.
It's interesting that you say that, because that's what I would say to Mike. I would say, that's how I get insights. And he would say, I go and I be alone. That's how I get insights.
I would say that you could share that your perceptions with several different people, and if the feedback comes, that you get is inconsistent, then you've learned something important, or about to learn something important.
I don't think the feedback is as important as you said, as talking.
As the process, you're saying, of being able to talk.
Right.
In fact, that's what a lot of counseling is all about.
It's not what they're telling me that I'm taking away, but what I'm arriving at in the process of the conversation.
And hearing yourself talk.
Mm-hmm. It's real interesting. I mean, that's what works for me, and it's just real interesting for me.
I often give assignments for journaling for students, because it's a way of getting your thoughts out of here, where they become a kind of mishmash, and getting them down on paper, giving them some reality, some concrete reality, back and looking at them. But it forces a person to put down what I'm thinking about. And the same, if you're talking with somebody, you're giving your thoughts some reality, and as I'm talking about my concerns or my problem, I'm in process of resolving it. Yes?
That, I don't believe, is the only way of letting it out. I think I could almost go around that whole wheel and take a part of everything to get rid of emotions. Physically, you can work them out. I know I work out my problems. Ironing, mowing the lawn, or working in my garden. And physically, I can walk in just looking at the beautiful terrain. Occupational, I think going out when I was working, seeing other people that probably weren't as fortunate as I was, or maybe giving more to my work, or maybe giving too much, giving a little bit less, because sometimes that can take a drain out of you too by giving. Some people become workaholics because they are working out problems that way. And intellectually, I think you can take classes along the type of thing we're doing right now, just talking it out and find out that maybe we're not so bad off, that we have, many other people have problems worse or less than what we do. So I think you could almost use that whole wheel in developing your problems.
And working through them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, as you say, you know, they said here, you cannot keep your problems within yourself because they just become larger. And I know at night, if I can't sleep, I get up and read, or get up and make some cocoa or something like that, just to change the environment or the situation or my trend of thought. And you can work things out if you are determined to work them out. I think psychologically you can. Knowing that you are a comfortable, you know, normal person, and that other people before you have done it, and that you can do it too if you want to.
Society has a flaw that it doesn't let you talk it out, especially when you go through a crisis. People are there the first week, but they don't come back the next month and talk to you. They're afraid they're going to catch that. They're going to catch that death in your family, or the child that you just lost, or something. They don't ask you about your child. Suddenly it's over. They don't ask you the next month, the next year, 2 years.
I haven't experienced.
So as far as talking out, mm-hmm. you know.
So you have had that experience, or you've observed that experience?
I've walked my walk. I've had many.
Okay.
But That's what I noticed the most.
I too have lost a child, and I just lost a husband within a year, and I know just exactly what it's like. But I have joined a group where we study the Bible, and it's just like, I don't know, that group has been such a big support to me and my church group that I don't know what I would do without them, you know. And like they say, if after a year you can count 5 really good friends that come back to you,
right,
you're very fortunate. Yeah.
But
I think you've got to keep yourself out where people will come to you, and I think you have to kind of keep yourself open to...
Well, I've noticed they really are. They have a fear of... That's contagious. I believe that's what it is. That might enter our household. We might have something bad happen to us.
So you're saying as a society we have difficulty in dealing with...
Right, you get all these cards, and I hated every one of those cards. Mm-hmm. I knew what they meant to say to me, but I didn't want to read those verses. Or they'd come up here and say, call me if you need me. I don't have to call everybody.
Well, I think you're right in terms of we have difficulty in our society reaching out to people after the initial event. Mm-hmm. Around grief and loss issues, we sort of subscribe a certain amount of time if people aren't back in their normal daily routines again. If they're still talking about the loss, we begin to wonder what's wrong with them. You know, they ought to be over that by now. We have difficulty with that. On the other hand, I think we have to learn as individuals how to ask for certain needs to be met. To reach out and say, hey, I need to talk. And I need to have you just listen. Not say anything. I just need to talk about, I'm really feeling down, or I'm really aware of my sense of loss around this issue. I need to talk to you. So we need to do both. To ask for our needs to be met, and also to be there and reach out to people. Yes?
I lost my husband within the last 2 years also, and I suppose I was kind of shocked when my brother said to me about, just a few weeks ago, you sure have gotten independent. Now, I don't know if that's good or if it's bad. He said, you sure have gotten independent. Well, I don't know, is that a good point or a bad point?
Was it good for you? What did it feel like for you?
It felt good because I had to do it. There was no other way around. You know, when you're left with all these things, what are you going to do? You can't sit and cry about it. You got to, like Jeanette was saying, all these things have helped me. Because I had, my husband had cancer, and they have this I Can Cope program. Mm-hmm. Well, I never went because I didn't need it from them. I got it from my church. And I belong to St. Olaf Lutheran Church in North Minneapolis. And they are great people. They stood behind me all the time. They stood behind me for 5 years, and they still are behind me. So I have most of those things. And this physical, I love working outside. I have a cabin. I have a house. And I have a lovely family. So I work around that whole thing, too. And it has helped me.
There are going to be different ways that we each are going to deal with this. And you say you like to talk to somebody about it, and you like to go off and have some quiet and discover who you are and what's going on with yourself in that setting. What works for one is not going to be the same for another.
I overreacted. I started my own business. So now I work 110 hours a week. And I said, I'm ready to go home. Okay. And it's been 2 years, and I says, okay, I'm ready. I've done it enough to myself, and yeah, now I went out on it. But I'm just starting. So...
I'd like to say, too, about support groups that you've grown up. I think in our society that has become so mobile, where people are moving about all the time and moving away from establish communities and families and friends, sometimes we find ourselves in places where we really don't know anybody very well. And support groups can be a wonderful
help.
A wonderful help, right. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of them springing up around all sorts of issues now.
I found when my husband was sick that there were so many people that just couldn't, they just couldn't cope with things. You know, they couldn't cope with the illness, or, and then they just went, well, I don't know, they just needed something all the time. And I just couldn't quite understand all that, because I didn't think I needed it all the time.
But your needs were different.
Mm-hmm.
And recognizing what your needs are and being able to find some ways of acknowledging that and meeting them.
Do you find significant differences between men and women and how they...
Well, I wonder about that. What do you think? Are there... Are there significant differences between men and women in,
yes,
in terms of what? Their sense of self?
Self-exploration and
self-image and...
Men don't want to talk anything out.
I don't know. Are you men going to
they keep it,
accept that?
I don't know. They keep everything inside, you know.
Haven't heard from
any men. They don't have any outside. Women go out to talk to each other. But men don't.
That's quite a generalization.
That's a kind of generalization.
You can't use that kind of a generalization because it works with everybody, individuals.
I know. I have a good friend I meet with every Thursday morning. We go over the whole world. Talk to him about problems with family, my wife. I mean, that's a real good support buddy. And I don't know if too many people have that, but I, as a man, need that.
How did you get it? Have you always talked things over with people, or did you talk things over with your dad or brother? Or did you always have someone, or did that start like after you had been married? Or, how did that happen?
I think it started in college when I went to a group session and I thought it was perfect, and someone said, "No, you're not perfect." And so it was a group session similar to this, and he said, "I don't like the way you smile." And I thought, "That smile is just great. What's wrong with you?" So I think it started there. So we started out thinking, well, maybe there are some problems. Maybe there are some things I need to work out.
That's all.
But I think a good friend is hard to find, and you need to go out and try to work to find good friends and make those friends. That's what I did. And then you can talk to them.
I think so many times we feel that these friends are going to find us versus us taking the initiative to find a friend.
And it also takes, sometimes it takes being the first one to open up. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like society now, because it's mobile, like you say, society kind of, they're really careful about who they might want to open up to. My experience has been that if I start, and I'm kind of a big mouth about things, but if I start, then I get some reciprocation, and then it works.
So you do initiate it?
More than, that's more right, likely it's me now. Mm-hmm.
It's if I talk where I feel comfortable, and I shut up where I don't. I mean, that's where I get to a point, I hit the wall. And I think it's easier for women to talk in certain areas. And then they hit the wall, and that's a very frozen place.
I think men a lot of times hide behind masculinity. They feel they, you know, have to be the strong in that. They,
macho.
They don't want to show their emotions in that. And they don't want to expose themselves to discussing deeper subjects like that with someone else. And I think the experience where it has happened has broken through that then.
So it's beginning to change. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
I think the women's movement has helped to initiate some change with both women and men. And men are beginning to see what they have missed, probably, and to begin to talk and take care of themselves in ways, nurture themselves in ways that probably haven't been free, felt free to do so before.
Okay, I think it does go back to your father image, what it was then, and it's just hard to break away from that.
That working hypothesis you had as a child and what it meant to be a man and what it meant then to be a father and how that's all played out and probably never revised, never reworked to reflect who you are at this stage of life. Mm-hmm. Interesting to think about the self and the self evolving, continually evolving and becoming a self. And you're still on your journey. We all are. I'd like to put in a plug for tomorrow. I have to get the book. We're going to continue this conversation in a little different way tomorrow, but we're going to be using the book Empowerment. It's a little booklet that is available in the bookstore. I think it costs $4. And if you come tomorrow, it would be helpful if you have purchased the book and have done some homework. It's about an hour and a half probably, to work through this. There are little sort of caricatures and cartoon figures. And it talks about who I am, who you are as a person, who I am with others, and then how we can empower each other, how we can relate to each other in a way that brings out the best in each other for this continuing journey of becoming ourselves.